chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven in the middle of it. Rest make the heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make the heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Buffer. We're going to start off this with a short clip from Mike Lindell. Mike Lindell has been standing up trying to expose the problems of this last national election, presidential election. And the banks are closing down some of his funds, particularly the one that he has a foundation for rehabilitating alcoholics and drug addicts. Now, isn't that fine howdy-do? Then we're going to move on to Rand Paul's questioning of Fauci and then Ted Cruz and so forth. And then we're going to find out what Carl Bernstein thinks about the seditionist. And then Kamala Harris is going to give us that fine speech about Pearl Harbor and 9/11 and January the 6th. Putting all those together, Kudlow's going to tell us about Pelosi investment. We'll just conclude with Victor David Hansen, and then I'll do some closing comments. But here we go with Mike Lindell's being closed down by bankers. Here we go with Mike Lindell, just a fine, fine person. Here we go next.
This is between you and your company or about people. And let me just cut to the chase. You're essentially being debanked. There's deplatforming and there's debanked. Mike Lindell,
right.
You're being debanked by banks that you've been in business with for, what, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years? Based out
no,
in
well,
this country. They're debanking
yeah.
you?
Yeah, there's what you just heard is a conversation between my controller and one of the bank officials for Minnesota Bank and Trust, which their mothership is Heartland Financial. Now, we haven't been with them for 10 years. I don't know, maybe 3-4 years. I'm not even sure how long. But this is where, not where my pillow's at, everybody. This is where the Lindell Recovery Network is. This is where the Lindell Foundation, Lindell Outreach, my store for all the entrepreneurs, and they want us to leave their bank. What you're going to hear on these recordings are horrific. Because now that you have, it's manifested from this, Steve, they're bringing back a year ago and all these terrible outlets like the Washington Post, and I just had a call from the Guardian today, and then you have the Daily Beast. All of these outlets now are attacking me, reattacking me again, trying to say I'm some kind of a, let's subpoena Mike Lindell's records. As you know, I went after Pelosi and that big committee they got.
There you go. Mike Lindell being assaulted by his bankers. And boy, isn't this a howdy, fine howdy day. But anyway, Mike Lindell's a good guy. He'll stand up to it and find another bank that's willing to help him recover alcoholics and drug addicts and so forth. But next we've got Rand Paul's conversations with Fauci, Dr. Fauci. And oh man, Fauci's like a snake. He jumps around and changes the subject and doesn't even answer the questions posed by Rand Paul. Rand Paul's a good stand-up guy trying to get to the bottom of all this vaccine problem and Wuhan and everything else. But here we go with their question and answer, you could say, episode in Congress just recently this week.
Dr. Fauci, the idea that a government official like yourself would claim unilaterally to represent science, that any criticism of you would be considered a criticism of science itself, is quite dangerous. Central planning, whether it be of the economy or of science, is risky because of the fallibility of the planner. It would not be so catastrophic if the planner were simply one physician in Peoria, then the mistakes would only affect that physician's patients, the people who chose that physician. But when the planner is a government official like yourself who rules by mandate, the errors are compounded and become much more harmful. A planner who believes he is the science leads to an arrogance that justifies, in his mind, using government resources to smear and to destroy the reputations of other scientists who disagree with him. In an email exchange with Dr. Collins, you conspire, and I quote here directly from the email, to create a quick and devastating published takedown of three prominent epidemiologists from Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford. Apparently, there's a lot of fringe epidemiologists at Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford. And you quote in the email that they were from Dr. Collins, and you agree that they are fringe. And immediately, there's this takedown effort. A published takedown, though, you know, doesn't exactly conjure up the image of a dispassionate scientist. Instead of engaging them on the merits, you and Dr. Collins sought to smear them as fringe and take them down, and not in journals, in lay press. This is not only antithetical to the scientific method, it's the epitome of cheap politics, and it's reprehensible, Dr. Fauci. Do you really think it's appropriate to use your $420,000 salary to attack scientists that disagree with you?
The email you're referring to was an email of Dr. Collins to me. If you look at the email
that you responded to and hurried up and said, I can do it. We got something in Wired magazine.
No. I think in usual fashion, Senator, you are distorting everything about me.
Did you ever object to Dr. Collins' characterization of them as fringe? Did you write back to Dr. Collins and say, no, they're not fringe. They're esteemed scientists. And it would be beneath me
I did not do that.
You responded to him that you would do it, and you immediately got an article in Wired, and you sent it back to him and said, hey, look, I've got him. I nailed him in Wired of all scientific publications.
That's not what went on. There you go again. You just do the same thing every hearing.
That was your response. And this wasn't the only time. So your desire to take down people.
You're absolutely incorrect. As usual, Senator, you are incorrect. Almost everything you said.
Well, no, you deny. You deny. Right. But the emails tell the truth of this.
No.
This wasn't the only time. Your desire to take down those who disagree with you didn't stop with Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford. You conspired with Peter Daszak, who you communicated with privately, and other members of the scientific community that wrote opinion pieces for Nature. Five of them signed a paper for Nature, an opinion piece. 17 signed a paper that called it conspiracy theory, the idea that the virus could have originated in the lab. Do you think words like conspiracy theory should be in a scientific paper?
Senator, I never used that word when I was referring to it. You're distorting virtually everything.
Did you communicate with the five scientists who wrote the opinion piece in Nature? Were they... We're describing, there's no way this could have come from the lab.
That was not me. What
did
I
you
did,
talk with any of those
see,
scientists
but
privately?
You keep distorting the truth.
Did you talk to any of the scientists privately who wrote the opinion? You did.
Well,
what were they telling you privately?
Well, let me explain. You know, you're going back to that original discussion when I brought together a group of people to look at every possibility with an open mind. So not only are you distorting it, you were completely turning it around, as
you usually
do.
Were most of the scientists that came to you privately, did they come to you privately and say, no way, this came from the lab? Or was their initial impression, Dr. Gary and others that were involved, was their initial impression actually that it looked very suspicious for a virus that came from a lab?
Senator, we are here at a committee to look at a virus now that has killed almost 900,000 people. And the purpose of the committee was to try and get things out, how we can help to get the American public. And you keep coming back to personal attacks on me that have absolutely no relevance to reality.
Do you think anybody has had more influence over our response to this than you have? Do you
Madam
think it's a great
Chair,
success? Do you think it's a great success what's happened so far? Do you think the lockdowns are good for our kids? Do you think we slowed down the death rate? More people have died now under President Biden than did under President Trump. You are the one responsible. You are the architect. You are the lead architect for the response from the government. And now 800,000 people have died.
Right.
So you think it's a winning success, what you've advocated for government?
Senator, first of all, if you look at everything that I said, you accuse me of in a monolithic way telling people what they need to do. Everything that I've said has been in support of the CDC guidelines. Wear a mask. Get boosted.
And you've advocated to make it coercive
and you've advocated that it be done by mandate.
Right. You've advocated that your infallible opinion be dictated by law.
Right. So, again, Madam Chair, I would like just a couple of minutes because this happens all the time. You personally attack me, and with absolutely not a shred of evidence of anything you say. So I would like to make something clear to the committee. He's doing this for political reasons. What you need to do is he said in front of this committee.
You think your takedown of three prominent epidemiologists was not political?
You don't want me to finish because you know what I'm going to say.
That was the question. Were you political in taking down these three prominent epidemiologists?
Senator Paul, if you would please, I'm going to allow Dr. Fauci to respond. We have a number of senators who would like to ask questions, and I would like him to be able to respond. Please do so.
So the last time we had a committee or the time before, he was accusing me of being responsible for the death of 4 to 5 million people, which is really irresponsible. And I say, why is he doing that? There are two reasons why that's really bad. The first is it distracts from what we're all trying to do here today, is get our arms around the epidemic and the pandemic that we're dealing with, not something imaginary. Number two, what happens when he gets out and accuses me of things that are completely untrue, is that all of a sudden that kindles the crazies out there, and I have life that threats upon my life, harassment of my family and my children with obscene phone calls because people are lying about me. Now, you know, I guess you could say, well, that's the way it goes. I can take the hit. Well, it makes a difference. Because as some of you may know, just about 3 or 4 weeks ago on December 21st, a person was arrested who was on their way from Sacramento to Washington, D.C. at a speed stop in Iowa. And the police asked him where he was going, and he was going to Washington, D.C. to kill Dr. Fauci. And they found in his car an AR-15 and multiple magazines of ammunition, because he thinks that maybe I'm killing people. So I ask myself, why would Senator want to do this? So go to Rand Paul website, and you see Fire Dr. Fauci with a little box that says, contribute here. You can do $5, $10, $20, $100. So you are making a catastrophic epidemic for your political gain. So the
you
only
have
thing
politically
that,
attacked your
can,
colleagues and in a politically reprehensible
the
way
only thing
attacked
that I
their reputation.
Okay,
you won't defend it.
No,
you won't argue it.
I'm
you'll just
sorry,
simply turn
we're
around
going
the
to
attack.
Continue this hearing. We have a number of questions from
just
another senator.
One more minute, please.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I really appreciate your response, but we do have a number of questions from senators, and we do have a second round, and I'm being asked to make sure that everybody has their time. So thank you.
Thank you very much for allowing me, Madam Chair. Okay.
Yeah, he tried to represent himself as the science czar, you could say. And he is losing so much credibility now. And other people have exposed Wuhan. He was trying to cover that. He financed it under federal law that was supposedly prohibited, the financing of the, advances of that, at that virus that they, gain of function, they call it, you know. So it's coming out now of what he really did. Next coming up is Ted Cruz questioning of the FBI during congressional, committee hearing. And they just say no almost to everything. But here we go with what Ted Cruz had to say in questioning some of these people. And it wasn't very, very good experience for anyone, but it showed the public what's really going on behind the scenes. And it's not good. Here we go with Ted Cruz questioning the FBI officials.
How many people have been charged with crimes of violence in connection with the events on January 6th?
Senator, I'm not sure exactly how many have been charged with crimes of violence. I know that there are
How many have been charged with nonviolent crimes?
I don't have the numbers of people charged, whether at the state or federal level. I know that
How many people are currently incarcerated concerning the events of January 6th?
I don't know the number of people incarcerated. Again, I know that
okay, let me ask you that. Look, we have limited time, so I don't want you to filibuster. You either know the answer or you don't. How many people have been placed in solitary confinement concerning the events of January 6th?
I don't have any information about that, Senator.
You know, Mr. Olson, I will say it was sad. Senator Lee just asked you about this. Back in June of 2021, Senator Lee and I and two other senators sent a letter to the Department of Justice asking these questions, asking about the differential prosecutions. Let me ask you, during 2020, Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots all across the country, there were over 700 police officers injured by Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots. How many people have been charged with crimes of violence concerning those riots all across the country?
I don't have information on how many. I would say, you know, hundreds of people have been charged, as Ms. Sanborn.
You would say, but you don't know. You know, when we asked you why the Biden Department of Justice has such wildly disparate standards, going after January 6th, targeting some people who committed crimes of violence, and anyone who commits crimes of violence should be prosecuted, but also targeting a lot of nonviolent individuals, we asked you why is it that you won't target the rioters and terrorists who firebomb cities across this country? The answer we got from the Department of Justice was shameful. On October 22nd, you came back and said, quote, "The department has dedicated investigative and prosecutorial resources commensurate with the significance of these events." By significance, I guess it means the political benefit to the Biden White House. And I will tell you, there are a great many Americans who are understandably deeply concerned about the politicization of the Department of Justice under President Joe Biden. It has been 218 days since we sent you that letter. DOJ refused to answer the letter. Today, when Senator Lee and I asked you about it, your answer to every damn question is, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. You're under oath. You may believe at the Department of Justice that you are unaccountable to the American people, but that is not the case. And the wildly disparate standards are unacceptable. Ms. Sandberg, I want to turn to the FBI. How many FBI agents or confidential informants actively participated in the events of January 6th?
Sir, I'm sure you can appreciate that I can't go into the specifics of sources and methods.
Did any FBI agents or confidential informants actively participate in the events of January 6th? Yes or no?
Sir, I can't answer that.
Did any FBI agents or confidential informants commit crimes of violence on January 6th?
I can't answer that, sir.
Did any FBI agents or FBI informants actively encourage and incite crimes of violence on January 6th?
Sir, I can't answer that.
Ms. Sadburn, who is Ray Epps?
I'm aware of the individual, sir. I don't have the specific background to him.
Well, there are a lot of people who are understandably very concerned about Mr. Epps. On the night of January 5th, 2021, Epps wandered around the crowd that had gathered, and there's video out there of him chanting, "Tomorrow, we need to get into the Capitol, into the Capitol." This was strange behavior, so strange that the crowd began chanting, "Fed, Fed, 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 Fed." Ms. Sanborn, was Ray Epps a Fed?
Sir, I cannot answer that question.
The next day, on January 6th, Mr. Epps is seen whispering to a person, and 5 seconds later, 5 seconds after he's whispering to a person, that same person begins to forcibly tear down the barricades. Did Mr. Epps urge them to tear down the barricades?
Sir, similar to the other answers, I cannot answer that.
Shortly thereafter, the FBI put out a public post listing, seeking information on individuals connected with violent crimes on January 6th. Among those individuals, in the bottom there, is Mr. Epps. The FBI publicly asked for information, identifying, offering cash rewards leading to the arrest. This was posted, and then, sometime later, magically, Mr. Epps disappeared from the public posting. According to public records, Mr. Epps has not been charged with anything. No one's explained why a person videoed urging people to go to the Capitol, a person whose conduct was so suspect the crowd believed he was a Fed, would magically disappear from the list of people the FBI was looking at. Ms. Sanborn, a lot of Americans are concerned that the federal government deliberately encouraged illegal and violent conduct on January 6th. My question to you, and this is not an ordinary law enforcement question, this is a question of public accountability. Did federal agents or those in service of federal agent actively encourage violent and criminal conduct on January 6th?
Not to my knowledge, sir.
Thank you.
What's real interesting is we've got a Carl Bernstein interview, and he's calling sedition. They're saying that he's guilty of, they're seditionists, that sedition, they're all guilty. The Trump people and everybody else just guilty of sedition because of the January 6th. I mean, isn't that, you know, gosh, that is totally, you know, totally distorted, incorrect. Propaganda. So, Carl Bernstein, you're propagandizing here. And you were the guy that exposed the Watergate, you and your partner? Yeah. Now what are you doing? You're just full of crap, you know? That's all you're putting out. So here we go with what Carl Bernstein said about the January 6th. He calls it, they're all insurrectionist and, you know, they're guilty of sedition and so forth. What a distortion of the truth that is. Here we go with what Carl Bernstein said.
You know, I've heard not just from Democrats, but also from independents and Republicans over the past couple of years, as one investigation of Donald Trump goes by the wayside after another, as one impeachment inquiry after another ends in acquittal, there's a sense of resignation that he's just above the law. That Donald Trump's going to get away with this. Donald Trump gets away with everything. The Manhattan DA, it's going to end in nothing. New York's going to end in nothing. You know, Trump's able to brush aside all of his contacts with Russia by you know, saying Russian hoax, when if you actually read Marco Rubio's intel report, it's damning and basically says that Donald Trump's contacts with Russians and his administration were basically a clear and present danger to the United States of America. But none of that ever seems to matter. I'm wondering, with the latest indictment, with insurrection charges, sedition charges being brought forward, are you starting to feel like justice may be served in the end after all?
I don't know. What I know is that we have had the first seditious president in the history of the United States. Jefferson Davis, who took the Confederacy into war, he was from the United States Congress, not the president of the United States. So we have a unique situation in which the president himself tried to stage a coup. And that's what the January 6th investigation is all about. And the amazing thing that is so different than what happened in Watergate, that what happened even after the Civil War, is that one of the two political parties, the Republican Party, has now committed itself to supporting a seditious president of the United States. And will he get away with it? He has so far. Why, indeed, was he not convicted by the Senate? Because unlike in Watergate, Richard Nixon had to resign because courageous Republicans, led by Barry Goldwater, the 1964 nominee of his party, went to Nixon and said, "You have to resign because you are a criminal president." No reporter, not Mitch Senator, not Mitch McConnell, not Kevin McCarthy in the House, has gone to Donald Trump. And McCarthy actually, as you pointed out earlier, said the truth on January 6th, and like a whole of his party in the Congress of the United States, with the exception of Liz Cheney and a couple others, has cravenly gone to supporting sedition by a seditionist president of the United States.
Well, Kevin.
What Carl Bernstein didn't point out was earlier, within They were spying on President Trump before the election in 2016. And then later on, they carried out a campaign to try to dethrone him, to indict him, to impeach him twice, and couldn't get rid of him then. And so then they trumped up these charges all during this period that they were assaulting him, you know, about this Russia connection and so forth. Well, who was it that impeded our government? Who was it that got in the way of presidential guidance and direction of this country? They did. So who are the real seditionists here? So, you know, it's all topsy-turvy, and those that are guilty of sedition and insurrection, they're the ones that are casting these allegations now out, trying to get rid of Trump and his followers and so forth. So this is very dangerous territory that we're entering in on, and I'm really frightened about what's going to happen. Now, coming up is Kamala Harris is on her speech on January the 6th. It was the first anniversary, and she tries to associate or to draw parallels of January 6th to Pearl Harbor and, 9/11. And it just does not wash. There's no way. And I don't know who her speech writer is, but this wasn't a very good speech. And there's a lot of criticism by a lot of different sources about her trying to draw parallels between what happened at Pearl Harbor and 9/11 in New York and January 6th. There's one person killed, and it was a woman that was shot by a Capitol policeman. And there were some deaths that occurred days later, but on that day there was one death. So they're trying to even to start that now. So anyway, here we go. I'm going to play her complete speech. It's about 6 minutes long, so we're not sliding her bit. We get to hear exactly what she's saying. And the theme of this is that this was an assault. In other words, it was an assault on democracy. And it was seditionist and insurrectionist and so forth. And so here we go with Kamala Harris's speech that I do not, I'm very critical of. Here we go next.
Fellow Americans, good morning. Certain dates echo throughout history, including dates that instantly remind all who have lived through them where they were and what they were doing when our democracy came under assault. Dates that occupy not only a place on our calendars, but a place in our collective memory. December 7th, 1941, September 11th, 2001, and January 6th, 2021. On that day, I was not only Vice President-elect, I was also a United States Senator, and I was here at the Capitol that morning at a classified hearing with fellow members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Hours later, the gates of the Capitol were breached. I had left, but my thoughts immediately turned not only to my colleagues, but to my staff, who had been forced to seek refuge in our office, converting filing cabinets into barricades. What the extremists who roamed these halls targeted was not only the lives of elected leaders. What they sought to degrade and destroy was not only a building, hallowed as it is. What they were assaulting were the institutions, the values, the ideals that generations of Americans have marched, picketed, and shed blood to establish and defend. On January 6th, we all saw what our nation would look like if the forces who seek to dismantle our democracy are successful. the lawlessness, the violence, the chaos. What was at stake then and now is the right to have our future decided the way the Constitution prescribes it, by we, the people, all the people. We cannot let our future be decided by those bent on silencing our voices, overturning our votes, and peddling lies and misinformation by some radical faction that may be newly resurgent, but whose roots run old and deep. When I meet with young people, they often ask about the state of our democracy, about January 6th. And what I tell them is January 6th reflects the dual nature of democracy, its fragility and its strength. You see, the strength of democracy is the rule of law. The strength of democracy is the principle that everyone should be treated equally, that elections should be free and fair, that corruption should be given no quarter. The strength of democracy is that it empowers the people. And the fragility of democracy is this, that if we are not vigilant, if we do not defend it, democracy simply will not stand. It will falter and fail. The violent assault that took place here, the very fact of how close we came to an election overturned, that reflects the fragility of democracy. Yet, the resolve I saw in our elected leaders when I returned to the Senate chamber that night, their resolve not to yield, but to certify the election, their loyalty not to party or person, but to the Constitution of the United States, that reflects its strength. And so, of course, does the heroism of the Capitol Police, the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the National Guard, and other law enforcement officers who answered the call that day, including those who later succumbed to wounds, both visible and invisible. Our thoughts are with all of the families who have lost a loved one. You know, I wonder, how will January 6th come to be remembered in the years ahead? Will it be remembered as a moment that accelerated the unraveling of the oldest, greatest democracy in the world? Or a moment when we decided to secure and strengthen our democracy for generations to come? The American spirit is being tested. The answer to whether we will meet that test resides where it always has resided in our country, with you, the people. And the work ahead will not be easy. Here in this very building, a decision will be made about whether we uphold the right to vote and ensure free and fair elections. Let's be clear. We must pass the voting rights bills that are now before the Senate.
Okay, that's enough of that, January 6th. I think we covered it fairly well. Coming up is Christy Lee's interview with Dr. Malone and this fever that may be coming out now as a result of this, the vaccine or the virus or whatever. But it's an excellent interview that Christy Lee did with Dr. Malone. Dr. Malone has been standing up against the Chinese and so forth and really saying it like it is. Right at the end, we're going to play some Victor David Hansen's views about the Chinese, about the woke, and so forth, about racism. But right now, here we go with Christy Lee, and we're going to follow that by Greg Reese's insightful, very insightful comments after that. Here we go with Christy Lee.
I know you haven't had a whole lot of time to review the Project Veritas story, but that did just drop last night. From what you've seen of it, how credible do you think that is?
So I think that what we may be seeing is one of two things. We either have a false flag operation aimed at Project Veritas and discrediting Project Veritas and anybody that will buy in to the Project Veritas narrative now around these documents. Or we have someone at DARPA basically throwing Tony Fauci into the bus. And it's really difficult to tell the difference between those two. There's some language in here that is almost, it's like catnip. It's so straightforward about the hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, et cetera, and the risks of the mRNA vaccines, and that this has been suppressed, and talking about the Trusted News Initiative. It is so consistent with what I and many others have been saying that you have to take a pause and say, this is kind of too good to be true.
I would say that. Like, I mean, does that make you a little bit more suspicious? Because it is falling right in line with everything that you have been saying. So it seems like if you were going to try and discredit a group of people and doctors, this would be a good way to try and do that.
So I had breakfast with Pierre Corey this morning, fortunately, and he's already looked at these things also. And he concurs with me that the wording here is so straightforward. But I deal with the DOD folks and Marines all the time, and they tend to be plain speaking. They are not DC bureaucrats that have spent their whole life playing kabuki theater. And in my experience, the DOD personnel that have been involved in this all the way through are not comfortable with what's going on. And they have been very clear and straightforward to me when I've spoken to them, including the colonel who was in charge of the Operation Warp Speed project for Moderna, who called me months ago, set up a Zoom, and was very, very plain spoken with me about what he observed. Christy, I've just been given authorization to read the following statement from Ron Johnson's office, okay? Senator, Wisconsin. Head of the Republican head of the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations. Quote, I've been investigating all these issues relating to the coronavirus and federal agencies' involvement in funding of gain of function and other dangerous research, as well as our response to COVID. I've sent dozens of oversight letters and my investigation is ongoing. So that's the official statement at this point. Received a moment ago while we were speaking. Why is all of the mainstream media reacting, including Google, reacting so strongly to this whole issue of mass formation?
Well, there's a joke going around saying, like, mass formation is a lie, they all say in unison, because that's the thing. I mean, so much of this is proving the points that you've made, even with the Trusted News Initiative. I mean, the Reuters, the AP, prove themselves.
Right. They're validating Matthias Desmet's hypotheses in real time.
You mentioned something recently about a new virus popping up in China, I believe, like a hemorrhagic fever. Can you explain to me what's going on there?
So Bannon's group is doing a lot of reporting relating to an outbreak in China. And apparently it is on the doorstep of Beijing, whatever that pathogen is. And it's been described as a hemorrhagic fever virus. Okay, so that language, hemorrhagic fever virus, translates, generally speaking, to a group of viruses that are in the same family as Ebola. Or it may be there are some viruses that cause hemorrhagic fever that are mosquito-borne and are also associated with problems, encephalopathy, disease of the brain. So something appears to have cut loose right before the Winter Olympics in China. And it seems to have got the leadership of the People's Republic of China reacting very, very strongly. Are they overreacting? Are they overreacting because they're concerned about the Winter Olympics being shut down and the whole political hit that would come with that? Or is there truly a new pathogen and a threat to the world? There's no way to discern that right now. I am not in the belly of the intelligence community anymore. I don't know. They're not calling me and saying, Robert, get your team spun up. I'm now persona non grata. This merits careful watching. That term, hemorrhagic fever virus, is one that is, that is not trivial. That's not a RNA pneumonia type scenario. And the speculation that a hemorrhagic fever virus could have been derived from a coronavirus through selective pressure of mass vaccination, that seems to be a stretch, but viruses do a lot of weird stuff and they can evolve in a lot of different ways.
What was important was the hemorrhagic fever virus that seemed to be coming out of China now, and maybe Ebola connected or something, but we don't know. This could be, they're floating another variant to fear monger us again. So, I mean, here we go again. And next we've got Greg Reese, and then we're going to close with a couple of short statements or interviews, actually speeches by Victor David Hansen about trying to protect our liberty and so forth. But here we go with Greg Reese, really insightful things about what's going on from the high-tech viewpoint.
When you have a society that has become decoupled from each other and has free-floating anxiety and a sense that things don't make sense, we can't understand it, and then their attention gets focused by a leader or a series of events on one small point, just like hypnosis, they literally become hypnotized and can be led anywhere.
Mass psychosis, also known as group mind, mob mentality, or herd mentality. Before modern civilization, we lived in herds, and in order to survive in the herd, we conformed to the herd. This is where mass psychosis all stems from. The most popular examples of explaining mass psychosis are typically angry mobs and violent riots, but these are merely the end results. Mass psychosis begins when the individual mind starts to identify as a member of a group based on any unifying factor. The unifying factor doesn't even need to make sense. For many people, the feeling of unity is enough. Our ego mind innately craves acceptance, and by default, will instinctively conform to whatever group it perceives to be the majority. In order to successfully conform to the group, the individual must put aside personal intuition and follow the guidance of the group. This makes a person highly controllable and spiritually stifles the individual, which causes them to crave group acceptance even more. Man's disposition for mass psychosis has been written about for millennia, most notably in ancient scripture and philosophy. And we all experience this as human beings, whether we reflect upon it or not. Plato argued that due to the nature of group mind, democracy always leads to tyranny and subjugation. His concern was the lack of good leadership, and philosophized on ways of solving this. In 1895, Gustave Le Bon published The Crowd, wherein he explains the key processes for cultivating mass psychosis: anonymity, contagion, and suggestibility. This work is known to have influenced world leaders, businesses, and tyrants, of which the ethics has been written about for decades. And yet, AP and Reuters outrageously claim that mass psychosis does not exist, when it is in fact the corporate media apparatus to which they belong that makes this all possible.
waging psychological warfare against a group of the population who believes the media would never lie to them. This is why the term mass psychosis is arguably a better term than group mind or mob mentality. A change in the field of consciousness occurs, a devolution from divine inspiration into primitive hierarchy, which has no place in a civilized society. And yet, here we are. Without mass psychosis, today's leaders would have no power. Just like advertising, everything about politics is about cultivating mass psychosis. Whereas the individual pursuit of happiness has inevitably led to beauty and innovation, creating and controlling groups of people, which has been the biggest power play on Earth for all of recorded history, almost always leads to death and destruction. The science and study of mass psychosis could be used to enlighten humanity by educating the individual about the power and potential of the human mind. But today, the very same corrupt media being used by wealthy elites to divide and enslave us says there is no such thing as mass psychosis. Mass psychosis is humanity's burden to outgrow. It is why we accept the lesser of two evils. Many of us are well aware of the frailty of man and the civilized world. The great psychologist Carl Jung's warning to the world was that the individual must come face to face with their own shadow. In order to accomplish this, one must liberate themselves from the collective. And until enough of us do, society will continue to be led by tyrants and ignorant mobs. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
So is this a man and humanity, humankind, not able to face their own selves? Now, this is what mass psychology, psychosis is about. Or know thyself was a Socratic saying about how to try to understand in yourself. But anyway, coming up next is Victor David Hansen on the deplorables that Bill and Hillary and all these people have been pounding out, that we are deplorables, the people that support a conservative viewpoint or whatever, or moderate, we're deplorables. Here we go with David, with Victor David Hansen.
Clingers, deplorables, irredeemables, dregs, chumps. That's what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden introduced to the political vocabulary. So we really, in a very strange way, it was very un-American. We just divided the country and said, these guys, or as the CNN reporter said of a rally, these are the people who have less teeth than I do in aggregate. Or as Peter Strzok said to Lisa Page, have you gone to the smelly Walmart lately? So we disparaged a whole group of people, and we called them losers in globalization. And then we exaggerated the brilliance of the people who had skills that profited from globalization. And out of that is developing this idea that we're really not Americans, we're citizens of the world. I'm not exaggerating. Secretary of State Blinken, you remember what he just said? He was calling in the UN Commission on Human Rights to investigate the degree of racism within the United States. These are people like Iran and North Korea. I mean, they're going to come in and tell us that we're flawed. The International Criminal Court wants to look whether into, and they did the last 5 years of the our presence in Afghanistan, whether we were committing particular crimes or not, is if the U.S. military has lower standards than countries like China or, again, Iran or countries in Latin America, Asia. And so de facto, when you surrender sovereignty to a Fabian socialist in 1900, a League of Nations advocate, 1920, somebody in the UN today, you are surrendering your freedom to something that is, let's face it, it's an inferior political concept. It's only as strong as its weakest link, and the links are pretty weak. And yet, this is what we're doing. There's something going on right now called the Great Reset. Mr. Klaus Schwab, remember him? He was the author and architect of Davos. The idea is if you get Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and a lot of professors and Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and you bring them all to Davos, and they can plan out what the world should be like. And if you read his Great Reset, He wants particular governments to surrender sovereignty to an international body. The first thing he wants to do is make sure that no one country gives tax incentives to a corporation like Ireland does, so that corporations have nowhere to go except to their body of high-tax countries, redistributionists. He wants corporate boards to reflect diversity, and their membership should be appointed on the color of their skin rather than their ability to bring a profit to their shareholders. He wants to make sure that we phase out fossil fuels on a schedule that would be turned by an international body. And he has enormous support within the United States. One thing we should remember is the Democratic Party is no longer the party of the middle class. If you look at the top 20 zip codes in the United States, 17 by income, 17 voted Democratic of the 20. If you look at congressional districts by wealth, the top 20 all voted Democratic. The Republican Party has evolved into a upper and middle class party. The Democratic Party is the very, very hyper rich and the subsidized poor. We should remember that, because a lot of what we've been talking about are the efforts of very wealthy people in Wall Street, Silicon Valley, professional sports, Hollywood, the corporate boardroom, the military, to virtue signal their superiority because they feel guilty that they either don't feel comfortable with the poor or they don't want them around. And it's a very insidious process, this wokeness and this wealth. I don't mean wealth is good, but the idea that people have so much of it, they're exempt from the ramifications of their own ideology. You want teachers' union for others. You want prep schools for yourself. You want everybody to have solar panels, but you have a private jet. That type of attitude. And that is what globalization has become. Let me just finish and say, let's not end on a sad note. What can we, the citizens, do? And I think there's a lot of things we can do. The first thing is we can vote. I think there's going to be the greatest reset, if I could use Klaus Schwab's word, in the next midterm election we've ever seen. People are very angry. And it's not a white thing or a conservative thing. I live in a city of 90% are Mexican-American, middle class. And believe me, they're very angry. And I think you're going to see a big everybody has to vote. The second thing is, I think people have to, according to their station, everybody has a different degree of autonomy and freedom and protection and family responsibilities, but they just have to say no. When they're called a racist, you can say, you can call me whatever you want, it has zero effect on me. If you're going to cancel somebody out, you can say, I could care less. Do your best. Do your worst, I'll do my best. But we have to all come out of the shadows and with one voice say, this wokeness has a antecedent. We know what wokeness is. We saw it with the Jacobins in the French Revolution. We saw it with the Bolsheviks that hijacked the Russian Revolution. We saw it with Mao's Cultural Revolution that killed 70 million people. We know where you're going, and we're not going to take this country. We have nothing to apologize for the people who fought at Okinawa. We have nothing to apologize for the people who died at Gettysburg or the 600,000 that died to end slavery. This is a noble tradition. You're not going to hijack it. We also have to get confidence that although we have lost, conservatives are worried about their families, their jobs, their community, and they're not activists. And then that laxity of all of ours, and I'm guilty, more guilty than anybody, the corporate boardroom was hijacked, the Pentagon was hijacked, Wall Street was hijacked, Silicon Valley, as I said, sports, entertainment, Hollywood. And they have enormous influence. If you go into Google, that search can be adjudicated by a result that reflects a political affinity. Donald Trump cannot tweet on Twitter, the Taliban can. So they have enormous policy, but they don't have the people. All the polls show that every one of these issues I talked about, the American people do not support it. And yet we have to find a voice. And I think the voice is we have to go on the offensive and fight back. And if somebody calls you racist and they say that they're going to do this and this and this and this person, they're racist. They are talking about skin color. There's nothing wrong with saying the woke movement is racist to the core. It's elitist to the core. It's discriminatory to the core. And I'm happy to tell you that every day of the week. And if we do that, I think we can end it. And again, it's an empowered citizenry that is the majority. You're not the minority, and you're not crazy. Thank you very much.
Here's Victor David Hansen talking about the Chinese accusing us of being racism, and China's the most racist country in the world. Here we go with Victor David Hansen.
A provincial government and high-ranking government officials in China, that's one of the ironies about it. So they understand the United States better than anybody does, better than we do. So when this woke thing started, I said to my wife, once we found out that it came from Wuhan, and once the Chinese government, as soon as the Chinese government said it was a bat or a pangolin, it had nothing to do with the stage four virology lab that had a hand with the military, I thought, that's it. You did too. Everybody knew that. And it was engineered. But as soon as that, I said to Jennifer, watch what follows next. And it wasn't more than a week later than we were racist. Now, you can call Ebola the Ebola virus for Ebola. You can call Valley Fever because it's from the San Joaquin Valley. You can call Lyme disease because some Lyme. You say Wuhan virus, or then you're a racist. And that's what they say. And this is a time when they put 1.5 million people in the Uyghur concentration camps, and they were pulling African residents off the streets of Beijing to check whether only they were infected. It's the most racist country in the world today. And yet they understood the woke mind. And remember one thing about the Chinese propaganda effort. We think in our arrogance that our magnanimity and our superior morality will be interpreted by them as welcome and will be reciprocated in kind. They look at it as weakness to be exploited. And they think, if I had all that power and I had an economy 40% bigger than us, and they do it with 330 million, not 1.5, and one American worker, even in this midnight hour of America, still produces far more goods and services than his four counterparts in China. If I had an $800 billion budget, if I had 7,000 nukes, if I had 18 of the top 20 research institutions in the world, if I had all that gas and oil, I would be doing things that would make what we're doing now, the Silk Road, the Belt Road, look like nothing. We would actually have our world hegemony. So they look at our constitutional system and our sense of restraint as weakness. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do this, but we shouldn't take them seriously. When China says that we're racist, we say, thank you. Coming from a racist country, that means you're racist. But we don't do that because it's part of the woke movement. China has said, they're the big propagandists behind this myth that there's a bunch of white nuts from Dayton, Ohio, that are driving all the way to the Bronx and Manhattan and Oakland and beating up Asian Americans. We know that, whether it's fair or not, we know that about 75% of the recorded attacks on Asian Americans are coming from African American youth between 15 and 50. Yet China would have us believe that this racist country that uses the word China virus is now attacking its own citizens, and they've got half the country believing it. They know more about propaganda and how the Americans are so sensitive to the charge of being racist or discriminatory than we do ourselves.
That's it for this evening. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless each and every one of you out there.